Hello, everybody. This is your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm coming up on 10 years with Progressive Radio Network. And if you're a listener to Love, Lust, and Laughter, you know that my deep belief is that your sexuality matters. Yes, your sexuality does matter. And it's wonderful to welcome back my good friend and colleague, Dr. Linda DeVillers, who holds the very same belief. I believe that's true. Isn't that true, Dr. Linda?
Yes. Yes, that would be absolutely true. Thank you.
And you and I have been in the field about the same length of time, and you've been very productive. You've had books, and we talked about, in September, we talked about your book, Sexy Food. Simple Sexy Food.
Yes.
And we're going to talk a little bit about, perhaps toward the end of the show, about love skills. Your book that is now in its sixth edition, A Fun Upbeat Guide to Sexful Relationships. So, Dr. Linda DeVillers, she's specialized in sexuality and relationships, yes, for over 30 years. That's where we're the same.
Right.
And, but you've been very ambitious and productive, and you're such a good writer, and you go to conferences a lot, and so do I. You might even go to more than I do, but so we both recently, Dr. Linda and I have recently returned from conferences. Hers was in Mexico City, the World Congress for Sexology, and one of the meetings that she attended was headed up by Dr. Ellen Lan, and I've just returned from a Quad S conference in Denver, and I want to talk about the meeting, the session with Dr. Meredith Cheevers, and so Dr. Linda and I will have a conversation about what we've learned.
I want you to know that I also looked up, I thought, you know, I know the work of Cheevers. Interestingly, she presented at Quad S last year, and I was there in Montreal.
So, and I was not there.
Yeah. No, so I'll be very curious. Yeah. I resurrected my notes. But, yes, this is really exciting research that I know you want to talk about.
I really do. And actually, Meredith Cheevers and Ellen Lan have something in common. I know this from somewhere that I read it, that in 1997, Meredith Cheevers heard about Ellen Lan. Is it spelled?
Oh, how interesting.
Not who was conducting, so this is over 20 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And she was, at that time, Dr. Lan was conducting some unusual studies on lesbian sexual response. And when Cheevers read Lan's work, she was just really surprised by its conclusion that gay and straight identifying women had similar genital responses to both gay and straight erotica. So this really got Meredith Cheevers' attention. So isn't it interesting? And they know each other, and we're going to talk.
Right.
I had to look that up in my notes, but we're going to talk about both women and their research. So let's start with you. You, my dear guest, Linda. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great.
Doing well, I hope. Yeah. Good. So, you went to the World Congress for Sexology, was it last month?
Yes, it was something like October 8th to the 12th, about.
Uh-huh, mm-hmm. Okay, so just a month ago.
Right.
And you went to a number of sessions, and you wrote me sort of an overview, and I'm hoping to get you back so we can discuss some of the other, because these are very wonderful topics, about sexual assault and the assumption about perpetrators that do not seem to be accurate, and about trans people. But today we're going to focus, yes, go ahead, Linda, sorry.
Oh, I was just going to mention still another name that we may thematically bring up, the name Lori Brato. So
yes,
Lori Brato presented at QuadEst last year and was rather amazing, and she was at WASP. So I, because I heard her last year and I could pretty much tell it, she was going to be doing something similar, but I just wanted to add that my experience at QuadEst a year ago, the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality, for your listeners.
Yes.
Some of the best research on sexuality today, and especially female sexuality, is coming out of Canada. There are so many wonderful, high-profile people. Meredith Chivers is one of them. Lori Brato is another. It's just, and of course, Rosemary Basson at the University of Vancouver. It's just really interesting to me that this is some of the leading edge work.
And it's not surprising, Linda, because Canada will fund research around sexual pleasure. And in the United States, perhaps it's because of our Puritan background, sex can't even be mentioned in a research grant request.
Right, unless you add disease prevention or some, very helpful.
Yeah.
Right.
So the research that's coming out of Canada now is exceptionally useful and about the only really good scientific approaches to sexuality coming out of Canada now.
Yeah. And the person that I heard that, you know, we believe dovetails with Chivers is, not surprisingly, not only a European, but specifically out of the Netherlands, which is also a very sex-positive country that supports this kind of research. The title of the presentation that I heard of Dr. Lahn was Sexual Pleasure, a Gendered Embodied Affair. And, you know, I found that title just kind of intriguing. And for all that we typically talk about, well, male sexuality works this way and female works that way, I just really liked her title, and especially when she said sexual pleasure is gendered. And what she was alluding to is that we put so much emphasis on male pleasure that female pleasure gets more dismissed or disregarded.
And the fact that female sexual response and pleasure is harder to measure and study probably contributes to that, but women have not been studied nearly enough, so it's a good thing that that these researchers are there, Dr. Lahn, Dr. Chivers, Dr. Brado, and so on.
Right.
Oh, and Rosemary Basson. She's another one from Canada.
Right.
Anyway, so back to Dr. Lahn. And a gendered,
she
said pleasure is a gendered embodied affair. Okay, what else did she say about that?
Well, she went on to say, which so dovetails with Chivers, however she says it at work.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, really.
We keep making the assumption that men and women are quite different sexually. And we imply that men's sexual needs are higher than women's. And she said, and, you know, everybody says, well, men have more testosterone than women. And then she says, wait a minute, we need to be talking about how that testosterone is metabolized in each of those bodies. And we also need to talk about ratios. So she proceeded to say women, well, first off, the potency of testosterone in women, you know, per unit, if you want to put it that way, is stronger. And that furthermore, if you start talking about testosterone, estrogen in women, I'd never heard this before, I confess, that women's testosterone levels are 4 times as high as their estrogen levels. I thought that was
quite haven't seen
amazing.
That either. That's fascinating.
And I believe, all I know is I believe her. I mean, she came across as a very, very sophisticated researcher, head of the Department of Sexology at the U of Amsterdam and all of that. So that was fascinating. And she also was trying to highlight that we, when we talk female sexuality, we all know this from sex ed on, that there's so much focus on reproductive aspects of sexuality. And then she said, you know, if you would total up about the average number of times a typical woman has sexual experience in her life, including penile, vaginal, you know, what they call these days, PIV, penis and vagina sex, that 99% of the time it's about pleasure, or it's certainly about male pleasure, and 1% of it is reproductively focused. And that's another kind of thing we need to put more emphasis on.
Yeah, there. I remember about 25 years ago, after the St. Clair Institute had me narrate another sex ed, I went on the U.S., I think it was called Sex in America show. And I was supposed to promote the Great Sex for a Lifetime, which is really targeted at baby boomers. Nowhere in the Bible Belt was that show allowed, because a lot of evangelicals, not all, but a lot of them, believe that sex is only for procreation, not for recreation.
Wow.
And, so it was an uphill battle. I mean, they don't get educated typically.
Now, was this 20 years ago or more than that? Or, I mean, do you think anything has changed? 20 years ago. I mean, that's still, if you think about it,
about
it was
1995.
Almost the 21st. Yeah. That is pretty shocking.
It's maybe eased up a little bit, but this is about 25 years ago.
Right. And given some of the other things we know that are sort of alive and well from the Deep South, it probably hasn't changed too much. Right. That's extraordinary. One of the other things that, whether she explicitly mentions this or not, Dr. Lahn also was focused on this same concept of we're so penile focused. And, you know, it's PIV sex is the only politically correct form of sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. And, I mean, it's sort of old news to say, wait a minute, women have a clitoris. This is way more sensitive than for most women, the vagina. And that she was also highlighting in her research on lesbians, I'm sure she found this, that it's been well known for a long time that lesbians were more orgasmic than their heterosexual counterparts. But there's been a little bit of a mystique that, well, we know that probably lesbians, after all, there's no penis around, they must use dildos or some sort of a sex toy. And she basically said, hello, there are fingers. Fingers is what most lesbian women like, and fingers get the job done way better, by the way, than penises. And I thought that was another intriguing kind of comment to be making that applies to both hetero and lesbian women, that maybe we underestimate the power of magic fingers.
I think that is true. Of course, we've also had an explosion in the last 10 years of high-tech sex toys that are quiet and go at different speeds and all of that. So maybe
that's true.
But I still think that a skilled lover with good fingers
And I mean, we know that oral sex is wonderful for most people, but
what?
I said we all know that oral is the other thing that, you know, most people, unless they're deep south, maybe engage in. But I just thought it was intriguing because there's so much. Well, oral is better than penetrative sex for women. That we shouldn't forget fingers. That's just what I thought was kind of interesting.
Yes, I agree. I remember maybe 35 years ago hearing Dr. Ruth talk about at the AARP convention.
Uh-huh.
I think it was about 30 years ago, and she said, well, some older guys get erectile dysfunction, but you always have your thumbs, she said. But I think that
right.
would include, you know, your fingers as well as your thumbs.
Right. Of course. Of course.
Mm-hmm.
That's,
mm-hmm.
Well, that's funny. Right.
Yes. So Dr. Lon also talked about gender differences.
Correct. And I think she literally, if she wasn't involved in the research, she certainly knows about it. But Janet Hyde is also a giant name in the field. She's, I don't know if she's emeritus yet or not, but she's at the U of Wisconsin. She's written many, many human sexuality textbooks, you know, new editions, and also is very well known for the psychology of women. And she's written a number of Psycho Women textbooks and been at all sorts of conferences that both of us have been to, et cetera. And she did a major, what's called a meta-analysis. It's when you go into the research and you look, you don't just look for one study, but you say, I want to look at all the studies that have looked at men and women and say differences in math ability. So not just talking about sexual, conventional sexual differences, but, you know, gender differences. And in her meta-analysis of very, very many different psychological traits, she found there was huge overlap between men and women that we tend to forget that there's bell curves, and even if there are slight differences in the peak of them, the vast majority of men and women are under the same umbrella, and that we underestimate all of the individual differences within a specific gender. So her article was called the Gender Similarities Hypothesis, which, you know, flew in the face of all of the evolutionary biologists who were saying biology was destiny and so forth. And so that was research that also Dr. Lon referred to. And she also ended her talk by saying, well, you've heard about the Mars and Venus stuff. She said, I'm sorry, we're all from the same planet, and it's Mars, which was a very interesting.
And it's Mars.
And yes, which was an implication of women are sexy.
Yes.
My interpretation of that.
Yes. Absolutely. And women do need more study, and that's what Meredith Cheevers is. Now, I'm used to saying her name Cheevers, but it could be your way. I'm not sure. But we'll,
yeah, whichever.
Anyway,
it is.
So she has a lab. It's called, she's the director of it, the Sexuality and Gender Lab, or they call it the SAGE Lab, and it's at Queen's University on the eastern part of Canada.
Right.
And she has a lab there where women come in and are wired up, especially their heads, because they're looking at their brains. And she and they're in a Lazy Boy recliner, and they're shown some erotica. For instance, she mentioned a video that comes up on the screen is shows a tiny blonde woman in a white bikini by the side of a swimming pool, and she graciously accepts oral sex from a kneeling man. and of course, this is a some people would call it pornography because it's so explicit, but this particular video that she uses because it has generous screen time for female pleasure. And a lot of porn out there doesn't have a lot of screen time for female pleasure. Anyway, right. what Dr. Cheevers did was to buy many years ago, it's about a $50,000 eye tracker. So they track the eyes. They've got the woman's all, she's all wired up, right? Her head right. and so on. And so we have the woman accepting oral sex, and then they get red dots to show where the eyes go. I think this is really interesting.
Right.
And so the bigger the dot grows, the longer the viewer has been staring. Maybe increasingly absorbed by the sight of a body, maybe a body part or an act.
Mm-hmm.
But then some of the dots come up on the margins of the screen. For example, does it mean she's averting her eyes in distraction or distaste? That might give the researchers an idea, because they're trying to understand literally how we see sex. And so these eye trackers, these brain scanners and other gadgets will help researchers get a more direct look at our largest sex organ. And what is that, Linda?
The brain.
Yes, we've been saying that for years, and now we can confirm it.
Right.
So other researchers, too, besides Cheevers, are using eye trackers, brain scanners, because they want to get a better look at what our brain is doing, and what turns women on. And her work is at the forefront of sex science.
And it's right up there. Yes, I totally agree.
Yeah. Yes. So one of the things that, and I will pause because I really do want you to comment on some of these things. But
we'll go right ahead.
Yes. So what she found, one of the things she found, I think, is really interesting, that heterosexual women's genitals become aroused when they view a bizarre range of sexual stimuli.
Correct.
Now, so this is, and you've read this, and I have too.
Yes. It's even been in the popular media. It's been in things like probably the New York Times and, you know, reading like that. Some of your readers may have already heard about this. And some major magazines. It strikes me as something that was probably, I can't swear it, but it's the kind of thing that might have been in Atlantic Monthly or something of
yes.
that sort. And my recollection is the bottom line was, I'm going to use that funny word that Freud created, polymorphous perverse. All sorts of things turn women on, more so than men. Is that not part of what her research is about?
Yes, that is. The fluidity of female sexuality.
Correct.
That they can get, they can watch, a heterosexual woman can watch lesbian sex. They can watch bonobo
right.
ape sex.
Exactly.
And her studies established that vaginal blood flow and lubrication don't always mean a woman feels subjectively aroused.
Right. That's also true.
This was just amazing to a lot of people, including people who are not in the field of sexuality, that the idea that women's genitals might have adapted to react to possible sexual violence in their environment.
Interesting.
And maybe lubricating to protect delicate tissues from injury.
That's an excellent point. Yes, and I've heard that before, maybe from her, from somebody. Yeah.
Yes, yes. But she says, Dr. Meredith said, women wrote to thank her. And she said, the experience I have is that women nod, yeah, and men cringe because of the implication.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that paradoxically, the knowledge that their minds and bodies were not always aligned during sex freed these women from feeling that they were personally broken. It gave the lie to such harmful myths as misogynist myths, I would guess.
Right.
Well, you know, you're wet. You must want it.
Exactly.
So this was a finding that really gave women some peace of mind. So she also has been studying different models of desire. And gender populations, and she'll measure clitoral blood flow. And of course, she continues to look at the connection between the genitals and the mind. And you mentioned Lori Brado, and I have her book. I haven't gotten into it too much, but I
have it too,
Lori
and I couldn't find it this afternoon, but I actually have it. I know I do.
About mindfulness, right?
Yes, correct. And I think the catch, too, with Brado, and I'm sure with all the people we're talking about, is that it's the notion of whether what precedes what. Does arousal precede desire, or does desire precede arousal? And I think what you're saying is that Chivers is saying, well, some arousal may not reflect desire, right? In a consensual setting, as a matter of fact, it's important to arousal often precedes desire, and in terms of using that to one's sexual benefit, it's about you need to create situations that encourage arousal versus distraction. That's part of Brado's message. Throw away the distractors and focus on the things that are more focused on enhancing the arousal element. And even I know that one of the specific examples Lori Brado gave had to do with even turning on the faucet of a bathtub for some women is going to, I think I know what I'm going to be doing in a while, you know, a mental enhancer.
That's right. It would be a trigger.
Yes, exactly.
Well, with these eye trackers, Dr. Meredith and her her assistant, I guess, who's getting her PhD, they want to know whether distracted watching, because they can look at it with these eye trackers, right?
Right.
Whether distracted watching correlates with sexual dysfunctions, such as distressingly low desire and arousal. And Linda, you and I both know that for a woman's low desire to need some attention, she has to say that it's distressing. If it's not distressing, of course, it could be very distressing for her partner, but if she doesn't find it distressing, it's not. We're going to have trouble helping, don't you think? As a sex therapist, we're going to have trouble helping her. And she, even if she's dragged in by her partner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do agree.
Yes. So, but anyway, the sexual dysfunctions, distressingly low desire, and then there could be negative associations with sex. And sometimes these are learned through trauma or taboo. And they may run so deep as to rewrite, maybe even rewire, the mind's attentional process. So, you know, this is all part of really understanding that sex is a whole body phenomenon. Mind, body.
Right. Yeah, the two are definitely connected.
Mm-hmm. And then the mindfulness that Lori Brado's book talks about is, and I bet you with your clients have been focusing more on mindfulness in recent times. I know I have, that because it seems to work as a bridge to sexual awareness.
Right. I'm going to ask you a curious question because I know
sure.
how I believe officially mindfulness is defined, but how in your own mind do you define mindfulness? And I'll tell you why I'm asking later.
It's about staying really present, and if you have distracting
right.
thoughts, like in Zen meditation, you call it the monkey mind, you kind of
right.
quiet down the monkeys and come
right.
back to center.
Right.
And I could go on, but what
well,
about mindfulness?
I'll tell you what
for
I'm
you?
Leading up to, that my understanding of the word mindfulness was that, yes, you will, what you just said, you will be really present and focus on whatever you're experiencing, if I can dare phrase it that way, without judging it. Now, is that part of what you understand?
Yes.
The reason I'm asking
I think that's
is,
an. I'm glad you brought that up, Linda. That's very important.
Okay. And the reason I brought it up, though, is because the truth is, for me, mindfulness has become a bit of a buzzword. It's okay. It's sort of the new in vogue thing. And
yes.
So I'm supervising somebody right now. I am an official American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists supervisor.
Yes.
So I get various people to supervise. And one of the people I'm supervising right now is very eager. And she just submitted to me a document yesterday. And she said, I'm writing up a description of sensate focus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something she wants to discuss with me in our next session later, the end of this week. And so I read through it yesterday, and I don't think I agree with what she's written. She's claimed she's drawn from various sources. I thought, whoa, she didn't ask me for my article about it. But she has described sensate focus as mindfulness exercises. And I think the problem I have with this is this neutrality ideal that mindfulness is about just let what's happen with no evaluation, or maybe I want to say, or no focus, if that may sound crazy. I'm used to thinking of sensate focus as something to get you to better attend to pleasurable experiences. Sensations. And I'm not sure that the word mindful, as opposed to, for me, mindfulness is not about, I think I'll think good thoughts, happy thoughts. It's I will have whatever is. I don't know.
I like
I'm
that.
Just really raising this as a question because, at least for me, there's a distinction.
Well, you're going to talk about this. That must be one of the pleasures that you have with supervising, that you work out some of your own thinking with the feedback you get.
Yes, but this is just quite a curious thing. I mean, I don't believe I've ever heard sensate focus described as fundamentally a mindfulness exercise. I mean, maybe you actually think it is. I'd be just very interested in knowing.
Well, I think the only aspect of sensate focus we should tell the listening audience that
right.
Sensate Focus was really discovered, or Masters and Johnson in their research gave the term Sensate Focus to an exercise that a lot of sex therapists, including Linda and myself, give our clients, and that is caressing exercises, also known as caressing exercises. It gets them to slow down. Intercourse isn't allowed the first couple of times, typically, that the couple does it. But I will say to my clients that you need to really focus in on the sensations. And if you find your mind wandering, come back to the touch. So that's a form, I guess, of mindfulness.
Right. Right. And I just realized the other term that most references, especially, I believe, Masters and Johnson themselves did it, Sensate Focus was also described as non-demand pleasuring.
Yes.
And there's that word pleasuring. I will be telling my person that I think she should, and maybe she should talk about their similarities between mindfulness and this, but I don't think it should be described as fundamentally a mindfulness exercise.
I agree with you, but that's a good reminder. I just made a note that Sensate Focus is usually described as non-demand pleasuring. I recently watched The Masters of Sex, which I believe originally ran on HBO, or could have been Showtime, but anyway, I have
it was HBO. Oh, that's wild. I didn't know it was still airing, but I watched.
No, it isn't. It isn't. I got a gift of the whole set.
So oh, wow. Cool. Because it ran for 4 to 5 years, right.
And so what it showed is that William Masters, before he married Virginia Johnson, because he was married to another woman, and anyway, he must have had some guilt or whatever, but he had erectile dysfunction. So Virginia apparently came up with the idea that he needed to relax more and be touched more and not focus on intercourse in the beginning. That was the origin of Sensate Focus. And sure enough, he got his erections back.
I forgot that. That's great.
Strong enough for penetration.
Mm-hmm.
But so many men need to relax. Haven't you had the feedback from clients that if they do these exercises, that the guy who maybe has had either premature ejaculation or erectile dysfunction can relax if he doesn't have to worry about intercourse? And what are some of what are some of the other feedback that you get?
Well, I agree. I think so much to what one of the messages I put out constantly to clients and students is that men are not sex machines. There's this whole concept that's so erroneous that, and we say, well, of course I know they're not a sex machine. I say, well, but think about how the language is used. You know, we say men have one-track minds. What are some of the other bad terms? I mean, there's just a whole variety of terms. Men are horn dogs. That's another
horn dogs. Men only want their own pleasure, and that's
right.
Most evolved men are just the opposite.
That
they really want their partner's pleasure.
And but the irony is that, you know, I always call them the good guys, and there's tons of them. Yes, think that way. But what they forget in the process that is a little bit of an unconscious endorsement of, I guess I'm a machine, is they're focused sometimes so much on their own partner. And or in clients, I'm sure you've had this especially, if you say to a woman, what do you like, she's a little bit more likely to be able to tell you, well, you know, I wish he would do this, but he only does that. You say to a man, well, what turns you on? Gee, I don't, they cannot articulate what it is that they really prefer. I mean, at least among men who have problems. I find that a common phenomenon. So they
But are you also saying, Linda, that women sometimes have the same problem? Because that's been my experience.
Yes,
and
actually,
we usually within the first session or two we can identify.
Right.
You know, if they don't know what they want.
They know what they don't want.
Right. They know what they don't want, but all of this is important to communicate.
Right. And, you know, you're reminding me, I don't remember who it was, but one of the other things that was part of a World Congress of Sexology presentation was the idea that it was rather sad that the typical, maybe we again have to say women who are having sexual difficulties, what's the most important thing to you in a sexual encounter with your significant other? Well, it's important to me that he is sexually fulfilled. And that's something like, you know, 30% of women said that is their most important thing to them. You're right. It wasn't about them. It was about the partner's experience.
That is rampant among lots of women. And it probably comes under the heading of being codependent, just wanting to please, not thinking about their own needs, but wanting to please another so much. And of course, we in our culture, you know, I left my cell phone on, and I'm just going to toss it in the other room so we don't have to hear it.
Okay.
Or I'll just.
Yeah.
It's my daughter.
No, I know, and actually earlier this
I'm on the radio show. Okay, I can't talk
now.
Hi, because I'm doing a radio show.
Oh, okay.
So I'll call you later. Bye.
Hi, bye.
I'm sorry. My daughter lives in Canada, and she knew about Merit Achievers because my daughter is married to a Canadian. So Merit Achievers and Lori Brasso are...
Right.
Big, and Rosemary Bassoon as well.
Right.
Yes. So I'm sorry about that interruption.
No problem. No problem.
Once I saw it with my daughter, I thought I'd just tell her real quick. So you say we were talking about sensate focus.
Well, we were talking about just the fact that maybe both sexes, that one predictor of people who have sexual difficulties is that they are almost, they're so concerned about their partner's pleasure. And, you know, that's where we go back, my gosh, Masters and Johnson. I've discovered that young people that I'm teaching, you know, maybe in their 20s, believe it or not, there's a lot of people, even in master's programs, who've never heard of Masters and Johnson. That's how, you know, long the field
I know.
Has been. But Masters
I'm not,
and Johnson...
I'm not teaching, but I find that just with my clients.
Right.
And especially if they're in their 30s and even 40s. They don't know about
Masters. They haven't
heard of it.
I'll say, that's amazing.
Have you heard of Masters and Johnson? And they say no.
Wild, because one of the things I say to, especially to clients, is, let me tell you what something those old, you know, pioneers had to say. And I tweak it a little bit, but they were known for saying, you have permission to be selfish. And then I sometimes add the word enlightened, that one of the things that they emphasized was another aspect, which was very non-sexist, actually. Nobody gives you an orgasm. And we must say that both sexes are more likely to embrace the statement, men give women, heterosexual men give women orgasms. You say, no, wait a minute. A woman chooses in the presence of sexual stimulation whether she's enjoying it or not. And if she's not enjoying it, the odds are very high that she is not going to experience pleasure or orgasm. So that, and the way I've often said it, especially to clients, was if each of you will embrace this statement, you have permission to be selfish, then you go with the pleasure with the understanding if either of you doesn't like a particular thing, you trust your partner to tell you. hey, I'd rather not do it this way. But in the absence of that, any sort of negative, as it were, or different feedback, you go with the flow and you let go. And enjoy
yourself.
You
let go, yes, yes.
And you know, men...
And that is so important, and that's where it's important also to stay in the moment. If you're having all these distracting thoughts, you can't let go.
Exactly. And both sexes can have that happen. And, it's just so helpful. And I think, in the process of doing therapy, that's what you really have to help people with. Go with it. Do not feel guilty about the fact that you are enjoying yourself. I know what I started to say. We both know that heterosexual men, especially, and I bet you gay men too, frankly, what really turns them on? A partner who is enjoying herself.
Yes, right? Yes.
So
absolutely, and a lot of personal and professional experience, both. I mean, professional insights is that highly evolved men really, really enjoy cunnilingus. They like giving oral pleasure to a woman. They like going down on her, and if she can reach orgasm that way, then, you know, he's right there where it's happening.
Right.
They like her smell, they like her taste, and all of that.
And I have to say, though, and very recently with a couple I was working with, this one is unfortunately, I think, such a hard sell for some women to accept it. I just don't like it.
Oh, for to accept, for women to accept it.
For the women. The women are saying, I don't want him to do that. Why not?
Right.
Well, I just kind of think it's, and they will dare to use the word dirty down there or whatever unfortunate, you know, sex negative thing there is about it. It's really sad. I don't know a super good way around it. You know, you can talk about bathing. But a man can say,
bathing,
I love
hygiene
your scent.
Is so important.
Yeah,
but I think a woman who accepts oral sex from her partner probably feels entitled to pleasure. For a woman to lie back and not be busy pleasing, just to lie back and receive pleasure is hard for some women.
I think that's so true. Yeah. And that's a good way to put it.
That they need to feel entitled to
pleasure. What kind of analogy can we use that might induce somebody? Well, have you ever had a massage? Did you allow yourself to have that feel good? Then maybe you deserve, but I had to pay for it. No, I'm just trying to think about what the bulking would be.
Pause for a minute. Let's go back to the massage thing.
Yes.
Because touching the head, face, and hands in the beginning of sensate focus and all that, resting exercises, that's a form of erotic massage. And I think in general, if couples, they don't have to be doing sensate focus, but if they start with a massage and they start by feeling intimate and relaxed, they're going to have better sex.
Absolutely. And even that is something, it's actually an American, Cindy Meston, who worked with the former chair or director of the Kinsey. Anyway, Cindy Meston did some pivotal work that dovetailed with Rosemary Basson's work, which was, you know, again, what are these things that sort of fuel the arousal in subtle ways? I'll never forget one of hers was talking to somebody intelligent was rather a turn on for a lot of women, not surprisingly.
Yeah.
But the massage was another major one. Yes.
Sure.
It does tend to segue. It doesn't have to. You don't have to go into it that way. But, it's just not surprising that sensual pleasure can readily evolve.
We started to talk a little bit about cannabis when you were last on.
Oh, yeah.
In September,
right.
And then the time ran out. And my experience of using cannabis for sex pot is that it does help you stay focused, slow down, receive pleasure, give pleasure, but mainly stay focused, mindful, and slow down. Do you have any experience with that?
No personal experience, but I do know from a couple of clients, and even informally, living where I live now, it's surprising how many people use it either recreationally or for pain management. But one of the things I learned more recently is how interestingly different strains of marijuana. And I know in my neighborhood, there's a couple of stores, you know, where you go buy it, but the workers there will very helpfully guide you to this one kind of tones you down, this one perks you up, and that I think maybe one of the tricks is what exactly is the issue. For example, if it's somebody who has a little anxious edge, then probably the strain of marijuana they would want would be one of those ones that really, quote unquote, chills you out, or just, and probably does help with the focus, not having thoughts. But I don't know. I just found that quite interesting because I was not aware of how many distinctions there are. And even, actually, I had an assistant for a while who uses almost daily and mixes the upper with the downer. I mean, she has her own personal formula of what makes her the most focused and calm. Because this is a person, for example, who wears earplugs in her ears fairly often when she has worked with me. If you understand, she's got an edge. And clearly,
yeah, but why does she wear earplugs when she works with
because
you?
She's hypersensitive to sound, and not my voice, just
okay.
She doesn't like a lot of sound. I mean, she's quirky, but she's very effective worker, but also very compulsive. And yes, and for example, if the gardeners are outside, that just, you know, we got to close all the doors and so forth.
Yes.
Well, I'm just saying that's a non-sexual situation. But my point is,
no,
this
it's all right. It's all right.
There being, you know, there's a menu, as it were, and we don't want to just say, how does pot affect you? Which pot is it?
Well, there's some debate about that whether it's sativa or I've forgotten the other one.
It probably doesn't matter
that much, but what may matter more is if a person, say in the past, has had a bad experience with pot and they get paranoid, and so you've got to, the main rule here is to start low and go slow. Yeah. I mean, don't, like with edibles, don't have the whole cookie. Have half
exactly.
a cookie to start.
Yes, I'm very
don't
aware
have the
of that.
Whole chocolate.
That it builds
have
up.
Half the
that
chocolate.
It builds up. Right.
Yeah.
And then if you say, "Oh, I'm not getting much of a sensation," yeah, you need to. That's another one. Just chill out. Wait a while. See how you're feeling in half an hour or so.
Or don't eat very much, and the effects will be stronger. And for a lot of edibles, it takes more like an hour plus. And, of course, you have recreational marijuana
in
California.
Oh, well, see,
and
that's
we've
why
had,
there's so much here. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've had it in Washington State since 2012, so quite a while. And
you mean only medically, or do you have it recreationally now?
Recreationally since 2012.
Oh, okay.
So it's been quite a while. We were ahead of California. And, of course, the state that I just came from for this conference, Colorado, has had it even longer.
Right.
And there needs to be so much more research about cannabis, and that it's still a federal, on the Fed level, it's still a crime, makes funding for cannabis very difficult.
Right.
In the time we have left.
Yes.
Unless you have something else you'd like to talk about regarding cannabis.
Well, I was just going to add briefly, if I don't know if any of your listeners travel much, but this is something most people wouldn't know. Several years ago, we were in Barcelona, and the cannabis museum had just opened about five months before. There is an amazing museum. And it goes through the whole history, and it was absolutely fascinating. And if anybody's traveling to Spain and Barcelona, I just recommend a little visit.
I'm going to take that recommendation personally. That's great.
You're going to plan your next
status in Spain. What is the status?
In Spain itself? Well, to have had the museum, I think there must be some legal aspect to it. Or remember that Barcelona is the one that keeps wanting to break away from Spain. So I don't know if it's all of Spain or within Barcelona itself. I don't remember having the sense that it was illegal, because I think it would have been like, this is a really, really weird museum. You know what I'm saying? It was illegal, but they created this whole thing. It was very, very professionally done.
Oh, so that's good advice. So I think in general, North Americans are becoming more comfortable talking about sex as an aspect of well-being. And we're slowly catching up with parts of Europe, I think this would include Barcelona, where fulfilling sex is more often presumed to be an aspect of good health. I've had some health issues in this last year, and I know that my regular satisfying sex life with my husband helped heal me. I'm sure of it.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yes.
And you know, that ironically, the person who was the,
Linda, that we gotta go. We're over.
Okay.
Let's talk in the new year, okay?
Yes, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Linda. Bye-bye. Se ti perderei nel labirinto di un amaro autore.